This is another episode of Stand Up Comedy, your host and MC, celebrating 40 plus years on the fringe of show business. Stories, interviews, and comedy sets from the famous and not so famous. Here's your host and MC, Scott Edwards.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this week's show. I've got another great treat for you. One of my favorite acts ever as a performer and a good friend. We've been known each other for over 40 years now. He's originally from Hawaii. He's a master surfer. In fact, he owns the Bonsai Surf Company. Ladies and gentlemen, Jazz Kaner. Wow. Jazz, it's so good to have you on the show. Thank you for joining us. What a nice time to catch up. I mean, you and I get to talk pretty regularly, but this is great chatting about comedy. We haven't talked about comedy in a while.
I should carry that canned applause with me everywhere I go. I
need that. Great way to start a day, isn't it?
Just every time I talk, it'd be great.
Hey, ladies and gentlemen, Jazz Kaner is a terrific comic. Started off as a opening or feature act, I'm not sure, but he ended up being one of our top headliners. He's a comic, he's a musician, and a heck of a nice guy. Jazz, how you doing this morning?
I am good. I'm jacked up on coffee and ready to go.
Well, I know our history with as friends goes way, way back, but in comedy, it started in the early 80s. You came to work for me. How did you kind of get started in comedy, or how did you get working for me?
Well, it's funny. I was digging through my calendars. I used to keep pretty good records. And so I left Hawaii in 82 after, you know, I kind of cut my way, got into the business opening. I was at the Don Ho show in Waikiki. That's right, baby.
Wow. So, everybody.
Don Ho, baby. You know, I did clubs and stuff around Hawaii, and then I decided to make my break to the mainland, and we went to San Francisco, stayed with friends. And your club actually was one of the first places I auditioned outside of the city. I mean, if you were in San Francisco, you did the Holy City Zoo, you did, you know, the local clubs.
Right.
I was doing open mics on a moped, no less. This is my rags to almost riches story. And Jimmy Celeste this is going to be the name dropping show, by the way. I've got just a list of names that I worked with through the years. So Jimmy Celeste was working up there, and he says, once, you know, you can come up and audition. I go, all right. So we went up, and I think he was with Bob Saget. Does that sound right?
Yeah.
I know Bob Saget worked up there. So that's probably when I met Bob. Yeah, and Bob was real nice, and I did an audition, and I think this was what was written in my calendar, and I can't believe I wrote this. I must have been really impressed, because Jimmy was in the back of the room when I got on stage, and he was standing next to Big Mac, and Mac, after about 3 minutes of my act, says, yep, he'll be back. And I thought, wow, that is too cool that I even wrote that down. I must have been impressed, so... and then what happened was, like, a month later, and this was my first full-time comedy, you know, club that I'd ever done. A month later, you called me back. It was like an emergency fallout to open for Paula Poundstone and Gary Shandling.
Yeah. And that was rough show.
Yeah. That was December of 82. And what's funny is, over the years, every time I ran into Gary Shandling, he always remembered that show that week that we had a lot of fun. And that was pretty cool because, you know, I mean, he was a busy guy and bigger things were happening, but he remembered that over the years.
Well, that's a great way to start with your relation with the Laps. We should explain, I didn't really give it in the intro, that you were born and raised in Hawaii as...
Kama'aina.
Kama'aina is a... No, but I was thinking of the slang for a white boy in Hawaii.
Howley. Yeah.
Being a Howley, being raised in Hawaii is not an easy start. And I'm sure that's where you helped, it helped you by developing a sense of humor. But you're right. When we first saw you, Mac knew what I was looking for. and you had it. I mean, you were quick, you were funny, and you had the guitar, which really added a nice extra piece that a lot of the stand-up comics didn't have. In working with people like Saget and Shandling and Poundstone, although Poundstone was really not a great act at the time, but it gave you an opportunity to work with some of the best. That's great that you had that in your notes.
Yeah, it's funny that I put it down. I kept better notes back then, and then slowly I started dropping the opening and the middle act's names from my. I go, damn it! Why didn't I put their names? Like, who did I work with that week? Because, like, then I was back. I think you booked me September of '83. I might have been with Bob Duback and Mick Lozinski. That was a hard week. Those guys were not easy on the newbies. I was probably the opening act still. And, you know, yeah, they were riding me. Then I've got on the list January of 84 with Eric Girard. You remember Eric Girard? He was a magician.
Yes, yes.
And he was the comic that told me, oh, it's okay to wear makeup on stage. It was like, what? He goes, yeah, man, we're performers. You could wear, you know, put some eye, you know, it makes you look better on stage. Okay. So I think I went through a phase where I was painting my eyes.
Really? You know, Larry Miller, who's everybody, if you saw his face, you'd recognize him. He's been in like 100 movies.
Sure, I know Larry, yeah.
But for the podcast audience, Larry Miller was a tremendous actor and comic, but he wore makeup on a regular basis on stage. And it was, I think, part of his getting, you know, like you said, for him, it helped him get that sense of professional entertainment. I got to tell you, though, I think by far most of the entertainers did not wear makeup. But it's interesting that Eric Girard brought that up to you. But being a magician, he was all about the look anyway.
Right. Yeah, it was more of a presentation. Well, and that was the week with Jay Leno. That was the first time I worked there twice with Jay Leno. And both times he was great. A lot of good advice and packing the room. Yeah, this is the old Jay, you know. And this is before he had the Tonight Show and all that stuff. And,
we were really lucky to get in with him early on. He worked the club many times. We ended up doing a couple large concerts with him. And he is one of those guys that was always nice to the other acts. You can't say that about everybody. Some of them were certainly prima donnas. And like you said, there was a hierarchy. The opening act wasn't treated nearly as nice as everybody else. They didn't consider you a peer at that point. Go ahead.
I think a lot of these guys liked the room because it was close proximity to San Francisco and LA. And your room as I recall, the crowds were great. And it was a good little slice of America where you could go and try out stuff outside of the bubble of the big cities, you know, where maybe the crowds were hip and you didn't get a real gauge of how material would work for the general public. And I think that's why you got a lot of great acts up from LA and stuff.
Well, I will add to that I did have several acts over the years comment that they were afraid to try new material at the Store or the Improv because you never know if some producer was in the audience might hear it. And if you're trying new material and it doesn't work, you need a place where you can bomb and it's okay. Now, of course, nobody bombed, but they could try material. And if it didn't work, they would move on. I mean, I remember Gary Shandling would take notes up on stage because he had written down material and hey, what do you think of this? And the audiences love that because they bonded with the comic and understood their role in the situation. I used to love that at the club.
Yep.
Now you brought music.
I remember Shandling.
You brought music into your show. How long have you been playing guitar?
Guitar is what I call my mother instrument. And then when I played music professionally in the 70s, I played bass more often. During the disco scare. Thank you, Janine Hansen. the great disco scare of the 70s. That's her line. That's like I wish I wrote that line. I played bass through like 75 up through the early 80s when I was working as a professional musician. And then, you know, when I got on stage as a comic, I picked up the guitar. And now I've kind of gone, I went back to bass for a little while when my son was growing up, because my son Kai is a great drummer, plays on cruise ships and stuff. And he was 6 years old and started laying down these beats. And I go, that's pretty good. I bet I've got a bass line for that.
Oh,
so
cool.
We started jamming in the garage. And now I've kind of gone back playing the guitar just because it's a better instrument.
Well, the audiences, the podcast audience has had a chance to hear you. I'm using archive material that was taped at the club and the TV show and stuff. And you're on that because you were such a major regular at the club. And so we do have some of your musical comedy already on the podcast. So thank you for that. But you were also a great comic that you were not, how do I put this politely? You weren't a highbrow comic. It was basic material that everybody in the audience could relate to.
Yeah, that's funny. One of the other notes that was in my calendar from that period was I was at the other cafe in San Francisco, which was a hip little, like almost a jazz room in San Francisco up in the Haight-Ashbury. And I wrote, other cafe need to be more cranial. And the other note on that same date on that open mic was the MC was Nora Dunn from Saturday Night Live.
Right,
and
right.
That was where she developed her act and stuff.
Yeah. Now that was kind of a famous club. Wasn't it also the one that had the glass, the window behind you?
Exactly.
So for people in the audience, in the podcast audience, let me paint a picture. So you have the audience, maybe 150 people. You had a stage, but right behind the stage was a huge pane glass window, because this used to be like a retail store. And so while the comics are trying to entertain, people are walking by and making faces and putting their heads up to the window to see what's going on.
It's funny you remember that. Yeah.
It wasn't really the best format for stand-up comedy, but it was a place to work. And a lot of guys, like you said, cut their teeth there.
Yep. And it's funny you remember that. You know, the highlight of the year in that room was Halloween and Paula Poundstone on stage telling a story about every costume that walked by, just ad-libbing.
Well, Paula was always good at ad-libbing and making fun. She was quick on her feet. She could make fun of things that were going on around her. I had heard about that story, but that's a very funny example of how the other cafe, the other one was, we've talked about before on the show, the Holy City Zoo, which had maybe 14 seats, 20 seats, and the stage was like a postage stamp, and people like Robin Williams got their start there. I mean, it's incredible stories out of San Francisco.
When I first went there, exactly, I called it a pirate ship. When I first went to that room, I was doing open mics, and I hadn't been there like 3 weeks when Robin showed up and did an hour just playing with the crowd and stuff, complimented me on my act, and I ran into him over the years. Yeah, he was a regular. He liked that little crowd. And he would go in there, there'd be 20 people, and by the time he finished, the room would be packed. People would be walking by on the street going, what the heck? Is that Robin Williams?
Yeah, exactly. And it's funny that you mentioned it, the pirate ship. Let me give an image for the podcast audience. You have this postage stamp stage, a few people sitting in front of it, but there was an actual crow's nest where I think only two or four people could sit up in this kind of balcony weird seat that had like hidden stairs to get to. And they didn't really have a good view. They were looking down on top of the heads of the comics.
Yeah, it was a weird little thing. We called it the spice rack. We had a lot of fun in that room, man.
But these are places that you could really experiment and try different things. And you weren't going to be necessarily judged by it, where in Hollywood you had to kind of be a little more aware of who was in the audience. Sacramento, I think, was a bridge between the two. We weren't quite as, this is going to sound horrible, but trashy as the other cafe or the Holy City Zoo. We were a true comedy club with professional lighting and stage and audience and people paying to come in and hear professionals, but you could still do things that weren't going to be heard in LA by some, you know, Hollywood producer that might kill your career or make your career.
Right. And I think to that effect, a lot of guys, you know, buttoned down because it was a paying audience. So they were there to see a show. You couldn't just riff the whole time. Although I guess there were those who did that, but I think you had to have some responsibility to the show. At least I did.
Yeah. You know? And you always pulled it off. I mean, to be honest, Jazz, opening act, feature act, headliner, I don't remember you ever struggling with a Sacramento audience. And so from the club owner's point of view, thank you very much for that. It is nice when you can find acts that you can count on to do what they do. You know, a couple others were Steve Bruner or Ken Garr or Del Van Dyke in the area that you knew that if you had an emergency and you brought them in, they brought it. And that was, you know, they weren't superstars, but they were entertained the audience and did their job. And as a club owner, I always appreciated that. Now, you work for me regularly at all three clubs for over 10 years, maybe almost 20 years, a long time. Do you have any great memories of working the laughs?
Oh, lots. one of them was, well, I seem to have worked there a lot during the summer, or at least the better stories were there. One of them, you remember Daily Pike?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I worked there a week with Daily Pike. We went to the mall one day, and just goofing around the way comics do. And we walked into a toy store. We bought some $2 toy swords. And then we proceeded to run through the mall sword fighting. And we would run into the women's clothing stores, you know, wherever the cute girls were working. We'd run in and we'd start sword fighting amongst the racks and the clothes. And we are here to rescue you. We're picking back you. And then tink, 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 and we'd be sword fighting. Then we'd run out and run to the next one. And
blood and guts and gore. You ought to have been there.
Yeah, it was a great time. Another time in the summer, apparently, rafting down the Sacramento River?
The American River. We used to take the comics rafting, yeah.
Oh, okay. So I never went with the club. I didn't even know it was a thing. Somebody came into the club, nice married couple. They said, hey, you guys want to go rafting? Yeah, sure. What else? And it was me and Nikki Shane.
Wow.
And the next day we get up and they're coming to pick us up and Nikki Shane puts on an Indian outfit. He dresses up, puts a feather in his hair, puts war paint on. He goes, we're going on the river, man. And we stop somewhere and he picks up a stick and he makes a bow and arrow. And then we stop. He says, the couple, or a nice couple, they're going, oh, we have to pick up some more people coming with us. Okay, great. You know, whatever. And we're parked outside this house and we're waiting. And the door opens. And ladies in bikinis start coming out of the house, piling into the car. And me and Nikki are just looking at each other going, oh, man.
Wow. So a potpourri of fun.
Yeah. We get to the river and we crowd into these two inflatable rafts. Nikki's got his bow and arrow and he's shooting crooked sticks at other rafters and everybody's having a good time. There was a kid. There was a story I heard. I don't know if we saw. Apparently there was a kid that on a bike, like a 13-year-old kid, and he would meet you at the launch area. And he said, for a 6-pack of beer, I'll ride my bike off the cliff into the river. And people would take him up on it. They would give him the money and then they'd raft down the river. And here comes this kid on his bike going off the, up this hillside.
Oh,
into
I've
the water.
Never heard that. That's hilarious.
Yeah. Yeah. He was an entrepreneur.
yeah, definitely. Wow, it sounds like some exciting times.
Yeah.
So,
and then
so,
another.
Go ahead.
Another hot, a story I remember was you moved us from the condo to a house and to a 3-bedroom house. It was like real hot during, and I don't know who I was working with, what week it was, but we're out shopping around, went in a toy store, and I bought a little baby swimming pool, an inflatable. It had to be 3 inches deep, like with a little ring on it.
Right, right.
And pink, you know, with little fishes on it. And I took it home back to the condo, the house there, and I blew it up, filled it with water, put it in the backyard, and we just, you know, watched the birds playing and stuff. Okay, so next week, we're done with the week. I go back to San Francisco, and I noticed that Dana Carvey was coming the following week. I guess this was before SNL and all that. And I run into Dana at the Holy City Zoo or something, and I go, hey, you're up at Sacramento next week. Oh, yeah, yeah. He goes, yeah, I'll be up there. And he goes, hey, how's the condo now? And I go, oh, it's a house. It's a 3-bedroom house. And he goes, oh, great. And I said, and there's a pool. There's a pool.
Oh, that's hilarious. Did you see Dana after that?
No, I didn't. I don't know. I don't remember. I thought, I'll just leave that little one there.
That's funny. I bet he got a kick out of that when he got up there. Oh, that's great. Well, you had many years of success as a comic musician at Laughs Unlimited, but you did other things. You were in the Adventures of Ford Fairlane movie. You made a couple quick appearances in a couple other movies. So you did a little bit of acting. Was it something that was just a thrill, or was something you were trying to do?
It's funny. When I started, like the first year I did the comedy competition in San Francisco, they took all the semifinalists, and I made the semifinals like 2 or 3 times when I did that thing.
No, not easy to do. Good job.
And I was like the pastiche entry. I was I think they had me for color. Just, he's got a guitar and he makes funny noises. We'll put jazz in.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, it was great from a producer's point, because you did do comedy music. You were you had a few props. And for everybody, Jazz used to go on stage with a couple coconuts and had at least 5 minutes of material using coconut halves.
Yeah.
And the fact that you were from
back to my Hawaii roots.
Right, right. And the fact that you were from Hawaii, even though you're not Hawaiian and don't look Hawaiian, was something to put on the marketing, and it was something different. So you did well in the competition.
So I did well in the competition, and they said, we have an interview with you guys with the ABC television or something. You know, if you guys, they'll meet you at the hotel. So we went in there one by one, and this was a big opportunity. And they asked, what are your goals? What do you know, producers sitting there. And I said, you know what? I'm enjoying stand up. I just like doing this. And okay, thank you very much. And I slap myself now that I had a big opportunity to lay down, you know, pitch an idea. And I just went, no, I don't like doing the clubs, man. This is cool.
You like being a road comic, which is not an easy life.
And that all kind of turned around when I got to LA. Years later, I think I got better at acting, and I really wanted to do it, but it was such a shot in the dark kind of profession, you know. I heard somewhere the statistic of people that are on SAG-AFTRA that have their SAG card, which I did do, that like 95% of them are not, you know, never work. They got their card, they did a couple of things, and they pay their dues. But yeah, it's just
the goal was to get the card and not necessarily be a professional actor, because to be a professional actor, much like a comic, you really have to work at it. I mean, I heard somewhere that it's like, you know, 50 auditions for one callback. And then,
And
10 callbacks before you maybe got to read a line. I mean, it's a hard, hard job.
Yeah, and I was not very good at it at first when all the opportunities were there for stand-ups during the 80s. And then as I got I got better at reading. I took acting classes. Jeez, I was in some acting classes in L.A. Sean Whalen, who is like a bit part guy, he's the nerdy guy from that thing, Do That Thing You Do, the Tom Hanks movie.
Right.
I was in a class with Tia Carrera, the nice looking lady from the Mike Myers movie.
Right, right.
A few other things. Yeah, and it's funny, I know her, I know them,
Right. Well, you did a movie before called Stand-Up Comics Take a Stand. What was that?
That was a contest. Well, yeah, it was a contest in L.A. Geez, I'm trying to remember who the finalists were. Rick Corso, myself.
They turned it into a movie?
Brian Haley. Well, they turned it. It was a TV special.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. I mean, nothing much came of it. I think it was like a national release. It was one of the few shows that was actually recognized from somebody.
Yeah, well, we should say you're a very successful entrepreneur. You've got a great company, the Bonsai Surf Company. You've certainly been a success both comedically and as a business person. But you did get a chance to put your toes into acting and performing for television and movies. And I know that you did a little international work. Didn't you go over to Japan and a few other places?
Oh boy, that's a story. Yeah, I did USO tours for the military. So
that's a great that's a great thing to do, Jazz. Not everybody would sacrifice and do that. I mean, it's a paid gig, but it's not easy.
Yeah, it was strange. You never knew, because a lot of these places didn't know how to put on a comedy show, and they had to be directed. Like, I like to go into the room and check it out first. And then, you know, if I could, without being an asshole about it, I would say, you know what? You got to move the chairs onto the dance floor in front of the stage. You can't have this moat in front of the performers with nobody there. It just needs to be, you know, there were little things about producing, and you know this stuff. You know,
it's part of what I live and breathe. But for the normal person, you don't understand. There's an importance to have a closeness of the audience, the right lighting,
exactly,
the right audio. You have to stage comedy.
Oh, it was, and the only thing worse than the USO shows were the colleges, because those kids had no idea how to promote the show or to put it on. And I find myself doing a noontime show next to the elevator door and introducing people entering the room and just, you know, put
and now joining the audience, what's your name?
Come on down. Yeah. Ding, hear the elevator ding, then let's
so you were doing colleges and some USO shows, so you did really get out there a bit.
Yeah, the colleges were like all over the U.S. in every little town that had a campus.
I would imagine USO shows. With your music, though, you did well with the crowds.
Yeah, it was always the guitar. Yeah, there were places where I worked with Dennis Miller in Houston, and this was, you know, before he got SNL. It was Rick Corso and myself, and we had a very memorable week at Spellbinders in Houston, and at one point we had a rough crowd, and Dennis comes up to me and says, "Hey, Kaner, didn't take you long to get to that guitar tonight."
He called you on it, did he?
Oh, yeah.
Well, the guitar, it's something about, and I've mentioned this not on the podcast, but in my book and a few other times being interviewed, that there is something that as the public is trained from an early age that when you listen to music, you show your appreciation after. So when a comic has a rough joke or a rough bit, there's no training of the public to give them respect for the fact that they tried. Where in music, you could be a fairly horrible musician, and if you get through a song or get through a bit, the audience, just out of instinct, are trained to have some sort of applause or respect for what you did. And what was nice was you as a headliner could bring the funny and really have great jokes and a few props. But when you brought out the guitar, it took it to a next level, and you always closed with it as a smart person because you knew there was going to be a huge applause and response by the audience at the end.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think it makes the act more, you know, if I will, durable.
Well, that's true. I mean, you did musical bits ripping off songs from the 60s that it doesn't matter how old you are, you've heard the song. Am I putting it correctly, or was it more the 70s? But I mean, it was you would do 60s, parodies.
70s, yeah.
You were parodies of really funny bits on music that everybody knows.
You make it sound like genius.
Well, I said it earlier that there was a simplicity to your material that I think made it acceptable to a larger audience and an easier swallow. I'm going to make a quick analogy. Will Durst is a really funny guy, but he's a political comic. And when you're talking politics, you never know who the audience, which way they're going to go, or who in the audience is going to be aware of what you're talking about or interested or even on your side. So political comedy is riskier. Jerry Seinfeld was very successful because he and Jay Leno are great examples of people that just talk about observational comedy in everybody's life that everybody can relate to. But you had the ability to use your personality, the few props that you carried, and then by using your guitar, you did parodies of really popular songs that were really funny. And I think that even though that might be a little more simplistic than Will Durst, you probably had more consistency of success show after show after show because there wasn't anything controversial. There wasn't anything that anybody could miss. It's right there. It's funny.
Yeah. Sometimes it pays to be a road hack.
Well, I don't think of you that way, but I was trying to, in a backhanded way, give you a compliment that from a producer's point of view, appreciated acts that you, and I said it earlier in this podcast, in this interview, that you could count on night after night, show after show. You did Laughs in the Park. I mean, that's a whole different audience, and yet, you know, you are able to relate to kids from 10 to 50 or 80 or whatever. I mean, it was, you have one of those acts.
That really came to the fore was when I got to LA because there were so many guys in LA, so many acts that were trying to groom their TV 5 minutes and their clean act and their stand up that here I was with the guitar, bam, bam, bam. And the club owners loved me. The Ice House had me up there. Bob Fisher, great guy.
Great club.
Great room. That room was so that, it, you know, I would say your room was a lot like that. The same kind of like brick walls and just contained laughter.
Low ceiling makes a huge difference. I've sat in the sound box for a couple Carvey shows at the Ice House. And I felt like it was similar to the Laughs Unlimited experience. The energy in the room reverberates off the walls, and the comic is giving to the audience, and the audience is giving back to the comic. And that kind of energy you can't get. Well, you were talking about your college and USO shows. You know, if somebody throws you into a warehouse and you have 50 people in a airplane hangar, you're not going to get that warmth and that feedback and that energy from the people.
And it's not even your fault as a performer. People think, oh, you suck, you know, but it just kind of looks that way, doesn't it?
Looks can be deceiving. You might have had that happiest 50 people on that airline hangar, but who, you know, you couldn't tell.
On my website, and I don't know why I revel in this stuff. My website is still up, jazzcaner.com. And there, the opening story, there's more than one article up there about my worst ever comedy shows. And it's funny in retrospect. You can go back and revel in the misery of some of that stuff and how bad it was. And
I think that's human nature. We all remember some of the worst things that happened to us because I think it puts the rest of life and the good things in perspective. If you could remember the two or three shows that really stood out that were difficult, that just shines a light on the hundreds or thousands of shows that you did that went really well.
And the ones that go well, you kind of take it for granted. When I was touring with Rodney Dangerfield, here, I'm dropping more names. Here we go. When I was opening for Rodney Dangerfield, one of the few West Coast shows that he did was up in Santa Barbara at an old theater, classic old, great room, just a beautiful theater. And I did the opening spot, you know, spotlights in my face, and I closed up with, I think, with the breakdancing Ronald Reagan bit. And I didn't know that I got a standing ovation that night until about a month later, and somebody that had seen me ran into me and said, "Yeah, you got a standing." I go, "What?" Because I just collected my stuff and got off the stage. I couldn't see anything.
Right, right. People, again, people in the audience, when you in a really professional setup, and especially that kind of theater where they're using spotlights, yeah, it's right in your eyes. You can't see crap.
Yep. Yeah.
So what was it like working with Rodney Dangerfield?
Well, I've seen him
naked. Did he acknowledge you? You've seen him naked. Ouch.
Yeah, you don't want to. That's hard to unsee that. Yeah. He always wore the suit, you know, with the red tie, and boy, he would rip that off as soon as he got off stage and walk around with an open bathrobe and his jewels dangling, and he didn't care, you know. Yeah. Rodney was good. It's not like we were buddies. We were from a whole different.
But he acknowledged you.
Oh yeah, yeah. I mean, I opened for him for several months, and in fact, I was trying to get him to do a show in Honolulu so I could, you know, make good big hometown boy opening, and I never could get him. And he told me, he said, "You know what? You could be in the most beautiful place in the world, but if you're not there with someone you love, it really doesn't have the same kind of thing." And this was coming from a guy who had, you know, lost his wife to cancer a few years previous to that. I didn't know that, but yeah, he was a card. The first time I met Rodney, I was at my manager at the time, Vicky Tunstall. I was at Rodney's club in New York City, and somebody had told Rodney, "You ought to have the guy open for you. He's, you know, he's the kind of act you like, you know." So Rodney was watching, and afterwards I get off stage, and he's there with his bathrobe on, smoking a joint in the middle of the lobby at his club before marijuana was very much, you know,
legal
or anything. Yeah, he's just sitting there. "Hey, you know, I think we can do something. You know, I like it."
Well, that's a great story. Well, Jazz, you've had a very diverse career, and you took road comedy to every level you could. I know that you did end up kind of hanging up the guitar and became a businessman. You run the Bonsai Surf Company. Is that out of Manhattan Beach? What beach are you on?
It's in Huntington Beach. We've been Bonsai has been here for 10 years now.
Woo! And, congratulations.
It's all on the website, and I'm the guy answering the phone so far. And
hey,
it drives me crazy.
Everybody out there,
surf counselor.
You want to learn to surf, there's no better school than the Bonsai Surf Company, and I've seen video and pictures. Jazz is a awesome surfer. Jazz, thanks so much for doing this interview today. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm not going to leave you without some great comedy. I actually have a set queued up from Jazz Kaner doing our anniversary CD. It's some great material I know you'll enjoy. Jazz, thanks so much for doing this interview and sharing some of your memories from Laughs Unlimited and working in the business.
Well, thank you, Scott, and thanks for running a great club.
Oh, well, it was a pleasure having you and everybody and getting the opportunity to do that for the audiences.
Great. Now we're going to have to start a new bowling night somewhere else.
You got it. That's right. We took you bowling. Well, you know, you were part of the family. We had you up at the club so much, but we could probably talk forever. Ladies and gentlemen, sit back and enjoy this great comedy set. Jazz, thanks for doing the interview, man.
All right, Scott. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, here he is live on stage, Jazz Kaner.
And, of course, the Rolling Stones. All I remember of that song.
Good laugh.
Georgia. my sunglasses at night. That's why I drive right through the red lights. Oh man, the clock must be slow. Just for the two people that understood that. Okay. Sweet home Sacramento, Lord, I'm coming home to you. I don't care if there's no cable, as long as I'm working for the Duke. All these hits on one album, that's right. Hey, how about Police Classic, Moldy Goldy from the Police? And of course the hits continue with the Police singing King of Stain. I found a little wet spot on our bed today, and I'm kind of upset because I've been away. And what would that album be without Billy Joel? She's a big round girl, and she's going down to Disney World. Oh, uh-oh, she's a big round girl, now she's screwing up the Tilt-A-Whirl. And of course, hits from those funky guys from Down Under, Men at Work. Screeching tires and the crash like thunder. Never catch a ride with Stevie Wonder.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was Jazz Kaner live on stage. My friend originally from Hawaii, who is one of the best comic musicians out there. I know you enjoyed that and his interview. Stay tuned. Next week, we'll have another great show. And look out for our new bonus programs that we're sending out, an audience of one. Hey, thanks for listening to the podcast. Bye.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of Stand Up Comedy, Your Host and MC. For information on the show, merchandise, and our sponsors, or to send comments to Scott, visit our website at www.standupyourhostandmc.com. Look for more episodes soon and enjoy the world of stand-up comedy. Visit a comedy showroom near you.